Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we find out what locals are saying about the Trump administration's move to change the rules for people seeking refugee status in America. We'll also get new information on the quest to better understand autism and learn why some say law enforcement, well, they need better training when it comes to dealing with people on the spectrum. Plus, local author Margarita Engel joins us to talk about her new novel, Jazz Owls, a book for young adults about the Zoot Suit Riots of 1943. And we'll find out why she's been named Young People's Poet Laureate by the Poetry Foundation. We begin, though, in Yosemite. Last month, Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke wrote in an op-ed that the U.S.'s national parks are being loved to death. He lamented the park system's $12 billion backlog in deferred maintenance. But another symptom of the overwhelming power of tourists is ecosystems that need to be rehabilitated. Last week, Yosemite National Park unveiled its biggest conservation project to date. And as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, it aimed to protect some of the park's biggest and oldest inhabitants.
Just inside Yosemite National Park's South Gate is the park's newest bus depot. You park your car in a big new parking lot, walk past the new Welcome Center, and hop on one of the hybrid buses that circulate every 10 minutes.
Come on in.
Ride just 2 miles and you emerge in another world. It's an old world, but it's recently gotten a makeover.
It's quite a transformation.
Sue Beatty is a restoration ecologist with the National Park Service, and she's standing in the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias. These big trees can live up to 2,000 years.
Those are probably 1,000 years old.
So they're just middle-aged. They got another 1,000 years ahead of them.
It could be, yes. That's what we hope.
A half-mile-long walking trail snakes through a carpet of native wallflowers, lupins, and young dogwoods. But visitors here look up, straight up, at the 300-foot-tall giants, the wind rustling their leaves. It's the first day the grove is open after a long environmental restoration. Beatty can barely contain her excitement.
Oh, I love it.
But just 3 years ago, Mariposa Grove was an entirely different place. The big trees, of course, were here, but all around them, asphalt.
This used to be a parking lot, a 110-car parking lot.
So you could park right up against these sequoias.
Yeah, basically people were parking right on the sequoias. Yeah.
The grove was noisy and smelled like exhaust. The asphalt diverted water away from the tree's roots. And an old tram road that used to weave through the trees was so narrow, Beatty says paint from the trams would rub off on the bark. Eventually, park officials said enough was enough. They launched a massive restoration project to dial back the grove's human infrastructure. The grove closed to the public in July 2015 and reopened last Friday. And while an extreme solution could have been to shut people out entirely, the park spent millions to delicately reduce the impacts of humans while still granting them access. It's a balancing act that Beatty says parks across the country are being forced to do.
It's becoming more and more common because the population of our country keeps growing.
Around 4 million people visited Yosemite in 2017. Park spokesman Scott Gedeman estimates Mariposa Grove is the second most popular destination in the park, after Yosemite Valley. The goal of the restoration project was to keep those millions of visitors coming, only without their cars, a gift shop, or a diesel fueling station to stifle the tree's roots.
Like everything we do here in the park and in so much of national parks across the country, it's all about balance. And it's about providing the access and protecting the environment. And we feel that this project really exemplifies that.
The project cost $40 million. Half came from the Yosemite Conservancy, a philanthropic organization that funds conservation within the park. Conservancy President Frank Dean says it was important to honor the history of the grove. President Abraham Lincoln set the land aside in 1864 as part of the Yosemite Grant Act. Lawmakers at the time referred to the giants as distinguished strangers and called the grove the wonder of the world. Dean says the Yosemite Grant Act was the first ever federal act of land preservation, predating national parks by years.
And so it was really the beginning of conservation in the United States and the world for that matter.
But with that came the need for balance, and we haven't always hit the mark. Neil Desai of the nonprofit National Parks Conservation Association says it wasn't that long ago that even in Yosemite, human access came with far too many liberties.
Decades ago, the Park Service was entertaining visitors by feeding bears from dumpsters while the public viewed the spectacle. And similarly, in the valley, you know, there would be a large bonfire built on top of Glacier Point, and the Park Service would push those embers off the cliff to entertain the visitors at the valley floor.
Today, he says, conservation projects aimed at balancing access and impacts are happening all across the country, like in Point Reyes National Seashore, where motorboats were banned from a marine wilderness area and visitors instead kayak and snorkel. Arrangements similar to what's at Mariposa Grove appear in Glacier National Park and the Grand Canyon, where visitors park in a central lot and then bus to where they want to go. Now, after years of honking horns and slamming doors, the grove is quiet, eerily quiet. But restoration ecologist Sue Beatty delights in that silence.
It brings a feeling of awe to me, a kind of a sacred feeling that I'm at someplace really special.
And she's not the only one who's attached to these trees. The giant sequoia is one of the few symbols on the official National Park Service emblem. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions made changes to the qualifications for those seeking asylum in the United States. To be granted asylum, people have to prove they're in fear of persecution because of their race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. An immigration appeals court during the Obama administration ruled those fearing domestic and gang violence fall into the social group category. Sessions overturned that decision. Now people fleeing domestic or gang violence no longer qualify for asylum. As Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports, immigration experts say those changes already have had vast impacts on people here in the San Joaquin Valley.
Thousands of people have been fleeing their native countries, hoping to be granted asylum in the United States. Jeffrey Clayson is a certified immigration specialist in Fresno. He calls the policy change horrifying. Most people that come through Clayson's doors applying for asylum are escaping domestic violence, he says.
Cases that walk through the door are Mexico and Central America. And those are the types of cases that are based on domestic violence. And that's exactly the types of cases that no longer exist.
The policy change has already turned some people's lives upside down. He says he knew one woman who left El Salvador with her toddler a few months ago. She was running from her boyfriend who beat her and slashed her with a machete. She spoke to Clayson the weekend before Sessions' announcement on June 11th. Within days, her case dissolved.
And so she fled the U.S. She showed me the scars. And last Friday, it was either last Thursday or Friday, I said, you can absolutely win your case. And then as of Monday, she no longer has a case.
Wynn Eaton is a certified immigration specialist in Bakersfield. He says his office also has a number of people seeking asylum because of the domestic violence. Some of those people could have other options to gain legal residencies. But it's temporary and doesn't come with any path to citizenship or benefits.
For instance, they might have Convention Against Torture, withholding of removal relief, but they will never be able to get a green card if that's the way they're allowed to stay in the United States. Because withholding and Convention Against Torture, what we call CAT, is only going to allow them to stay here for their protection, but it doesn't give them a path to residency or citizenship the way an asylee would benefited.
Now that the rules have changed, it's unclear what will happen to asylees with open cases. Eaton says it's very likely they will be denied and deported. There is also no guarantee they will be protected if they have to go back to their countries. He says most could endure more brutality or even death. He calls the policy changes horrible.
These are people that are fleeing horrible circumstances. And now we've politicized the process by putting the political appointee, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States, in the middle of rendering these edicts.
Many of the people Eaton works with come to the U.S. as a last resort. He says many would rather stay in their native countries, but if they do, they can't keep their family safe. Eaton's office also represents asylees fearful of gang violence. Gang members will often use kids as bargaining chips to get working families to give them thousands of dollars. And when they fall short on cash, gang members kill their children.
One woman said it best here a little while ago. She told me directly that she would rather have her son, who is at that time 11 years old, die en route to the United States or seeking refuge someplace than to be forced to join one of the gangs and to lose his life in a criminal environment.
Although some Valley Republicans say Sessions' decision needed to happen and is a step in the right direction, Guillermo Moreno is with the Fresno County Republican Party. He agrees with Sessions and says citing domestic or gang violence shouldn't be part of asylum policy.
So the fact that General Jeff Sessions came out with this and just reiterated the fact that, you know, this is not, you know, we can't do this. We can't just open it up for everyone in every single, every single circumstance. I mean, it's something that, you know, had to be done.
The thousands of people who applied for asylum citing domestic and gang violence has backed up court, says Moreno. Some of those being cases that don't have merit and get denied, he says, and that becomes a problem.
You know, this new direction will more than likely help those that are truly seeking to enter the country under a valid asylum claim.
The corrupt government systems in Latin American countries also hold responsibility, says Moreno. They need to do more for victims of domestic and gang violence. If the U.S. government wants to continue to step in and help victims in these situations, then that should be addressed separately, says Moreno, not as an asylum claim. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Former Fresno Bee reporter Hannah Ferfaro has a new beat covering the condition autism for a new publication called Spectrum. She has two very interesting new reports out with that publication online, looking at issues of early childhood development and also the way the law enforcement community works with people with the condition. Hannah joins us now to talk about that and more. Hannah, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
I want to start out and talk a little about this new publication that you're with now called Spectrum before we get into the specifics of the two articles, which are very interesting. Tell me a little about what Spectrum is. Is this a general interest publication covering autism? What's the mission of Spectrum?
Sure. Spectrum is an online publication. We're based in New York, and we're a team of journalists who are devoted to covering research in the autism field. So our primary readers are actually scientists who are working on research related to autism and other conditions like Fragile X and Rett syndrome, which are also neurodevelopmental disorders. But we also have clinicians and parents come to our website, and sometimes some of our stories are syndicated by national publications. So those are our stories that appeal more to a general audience. Like the story that we're going to discuss today, which was republished in The Atlantic.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that one to start out with, the one specifically about early childhood development. This story is interesting because you're looking at the growth patterns of children with autism and those without. Let's look at the initial overview of this article. What is the big takeaway here?
Sure. So this is just an example of the type of news coverage that we do at Spectrum. Our reporters write about the latest research, and this study was interesting to us because it was really one of the first that looked at skeletal growth in autism. And so what that means is simply the height of a child. And there have been a lot of studies that indicate that children with autism have differences in their head circumference, but their height hadn't been looked at in a really critical sort of way. And so the researchers in this study that I write about are from Australia, and they used infant growth charts from children who just went to their regular checkup visits when they were infants And what they found is that although children with autism seem to be born smaller and have smaller heads and also weigh less than typical kids, by the time they're 3 years old, they've actually grown taller and their heads are bigger. They didn't really see a difference in weight by the time the kids were infants. I should say toddlers, but they did see that these kids were growing faster, which is sort of intriguing.
Are they looking at causation or this correlation?
At this point, they have, they speculate as to why these kids might be growing faster, but they don't really know the reason. They speculate that genes that have been linked to autism could be related to the skeletal growth. There's also a chance that these kids have a hormone imbalance that typical kids don't have, but they really weren't able to get at the root of why these kids are growing faster. I think that's something that they want to explore in other research, and I know when I talked to the researchers for this story, they said that they also want to explore this sort of trend in adolescents and teenagers to see if it also shows up in that age group. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to get to the bottom of it.
How significant, potentially, is this initial study that you're reporting on now? And what's the buzz been in the autism community about what these researchers have at least discovered initially?
Well, I think, the researchers who I talk to, they think that this will really be sort of a launch pad for other researchers to invest more time and research into skeletal growth. As I said, very little work has been done in this area, although there are a few researchers who are hoping that more people in the field will focus on it. This particular story was picked up by Scientific American, so I think that, it did get a broader readership. I didn't hear feedback from parents, and I'm not sure that we can really say much about how you could use this information clinically yet, but I think the big sort of takeaway or buzz about this is researchers getting more interested in studying this area.
Now, I understand this study involved only infant boys, young boys, and not girls. Is there any significance there?
Yeah, that's a good point. Unfortunately, a lot of studies on autism lack girls or have few girls, and part of the reason for that is because fewer girls receive the diagnosis of autism. That's not to say that just because they're not diagnosed, they don't actually have autism. There's sort of a problem in this field where many girls actually are either misdiagnosed or they aren't picked up by the traditional tests that measure for autism. But, when I talked to the researchers about this, why didn't you include girls? They said that really the reason is because it's difficult to get girls to participate in studies just because there are so few of them who are diagnosed. I think that, of course, they would love to include girls in their future work if they're able to.
Does that go for other studies also, looking at other things related to autism?
It does, yeah. A lot of the studies that I report about, there are very few girls. I think that there are a few research groups who are really devoting efforts to recruiting more women and girls. Of course, adults, there are adults with autism too, and so it's important to find both adults and infants and older children, both boys and girls who are able to participate in research.
So that was one report of yours that got a lot of attention, as you mentioned, Scientific American picking that up. The other one that recently came out from Spectrum and also has been picked up more broadly, it deals with the way that law enforcement groups, police, sheriff's deputies, others, deal with people who have autism. And what do we know about the way that departments train their officers right now when it comes to recognizing and moderating their behavior when it comes to dealing with people with this condition?
So for this story, I conducted a survey of the 30 largest police departments in the U.S., and really my goal with that survey was to try to understand the question you just asked, which is how frequently do people with autism come into contact with police, and what do these encounters look like? And, sort of surprisingly to me, at the beginning of my reporting, there was very little information out there on this, so I tried to figure it out a bit on my own. And of the departments that responded to me, I was able to find out a little bit about this. It seems as though most departments really don't track incidents involving people with autism, so it was hard to get a sense of how often these encounters end in violence or end peacefully. When I asked them questions about training, I really got a mixed response. A lot of the larger police departments, like NYPD, for example, they have very stringent mandates about how they train their officers. Other departments have sort of, they responded with a mixed bag. They said, you know, we might have a course on developmental disabilities in general, but, you know, we'll fold in information about autism if we can. It's really hard to say across the board what police departments are doing. But I think overall, the sense I got was that they want to do more.
Are there any best practices out there?
I think there are. One of the takeaways from the article was that the police departments that are doing a good job have sort of manual for best practices. And these involve things like speaking calmly if they encounter someone with autism. As you might know, people with this condition sometimes have sensitivities to sensory experiences. So that means just an increased awareness to bright lights that they see or loud sounds. And, you know, if you're encountering a police officer or you hear the sirens behind you, that can be really disturbing for someone with autism in certain circumstances. And so using a calm voice and not touching the person, and, you know, sometimes people with autism, they have repetitive behaviors, and, you know, an officer can choose to not tell that person to stop what they're doing and doing their repetitive behavior, which can be calming to them. Just things like that to help accommodate the person and help them feel more comfortable in that situation.
Tell me the story of this this person in Alabama who is mentioned in your article and their encounter with police. How did that go?
So the woman in my story who I mentioned, her name is Joanna Verberg, and she earlier this year actually was diagnosed with autism, and she's a mother of two children with autism, and she was visiting her daughter's therapy appointment in March and ended up getting into an argument with another woman. The police were called, and she was escorted out, and over the course of this instance, she identified to the police officer that she had autism, and what she told me is that as soon as she identified herself that way, the police officer became agitated and increasingly aggressive and eventually arrested her. And this was really a concern to her because she thought that by mentioning her diagnosis, the officer might react differently and might actually accommodate her. And, going forward, I think that was something that she's thinking about a lot since she's raising two kids who have this condition, and she's trying to instruct them about how to deal with police, and especially in instances where it seems as though the officer isn't trained and doesn't know what to do in that sort of situation.
In talking with other people with autism, is this a common concern that they have with dealing with law enforcement?
I think it is. Everyone who I talked to for this story, especially individuals with autism and also people who are parents of children with autism, told me that this is a real concern that they have. One of the parents who I talked to, she has an adult son, and she was just concerned that on his late night walks home from his job at McDonald's, something as simple as just a walk home could put him in danger. He has trouble with communication, and he might look to someone who doesn't know what autism is like a suspicious person, but really these might just be features of autism. And so parents, I think, are really worried about talking to their kids, and also they're worried about the fact that they feel like the burden is on them to know how to deal with that sort of situation. They think that really police departments and states need to take it upon themselves to make this sort of training mandatory so police officers can sort of handle that situation and people with autism don't have to be the ones who know all the hoops to jump through to make sure that everything goes peacefully.
You write about a study that looked at some incidents or some data regarding incidents with law enforcement, and you write that nearly 20% of young people on the spectrum have had run-ins with police by age 21. Is there also, though, a risk, just even as a reporter here covering an issue like this, is there a risk of perhaps reinforcing stigma that maybe some people have mistakenly about people on the spectrum when it comes to things like dealing with law enforcement and interactions there?
I think that there's been some reporting about people with autism perpetuating violence and crimes. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. That I know that there are some autism activists and advocates that that say, you know, we don't want to paint with a broad brush here and don't want to be labeled as this condition makes us more likely to have some sort of an interaction. Is that something that you've encountered? And just maybe talk about that element of the issue of law enforcement interactions with individuals with autism.
Sure. In the story, I talked with a researcher, Matt Lerner, and he was actually on the Sandy Hook Commission. And if you remember from that commission, Adam Lanza, you know, there was an indication that he had autism. And this researcher who testified, essentially his role was to say, what did autism play any sort of role in the Sandy Hook massacre? And he testified that there's really no evidence that people with autism commit crimes any more than anybody else. And I think, you know, part of his point there was that there's no research to suggest that. And I think the point of this article was really to highlight that, in fact, people with autism often are the victims of violence, including violence by police. So I would hope that people who read the article would understand that sort of distinction.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job of reporting on this in a sensitive way. Before we go, Hannah, just tell me a little more about going to this new beat. What has that been like? Again, people here in the Valley probably remember your byline from your days with the Fresno Bee, covering a variety of things, education beyond. What's it been like going in a deep dive and a very specific beat in the in the world of scientific research and medical conditions and specifically with autism?
I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, when I left the Bee, I actually moved to New York and went to graduate school at Columbia, and I got a master's in science and health journalism. So this is a very big change from what I was reporting on at the Bee, but it's something that I'm really passionate about, and I think that good science journalism is needed everywhere, and the opportunity to go into a very specific topic has been really incredible.
And also with these last two stories getting a broader based coverage from beyond just a specifically focused publication like yours, is there, do you think, a desire in the general public for more in-depth coverage of a condition like autism?
I think there is, and there are very few publications out there that really delve into a specific condition. Spectrum is really unique in that we're able to have a base of researchers who we can go to time and time again and really stay up to date on the latest research. And so I think we really provide a service to not only researchers, but parents and people with autism and clinicians. And so I think, you know, the fact that these stories are able to get out there to a more general public is great, and I hope that we can continue to do that.
And you can read Hannah's fine reporting online at spectrumnews.org. Two recent articles, one about police and the need for better training when it comes to how they interact with people with autism and on the spectrum. And then also another piece about a new research on early childhood development when it comes to autism, specifically with young boys and a growth spurt that seems to be happening in some cases there. Hannah Ferfaro, formerly with the Fresno Bee, now with the autism-specific focus publication Spectrum. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Over a year ago, a massive mud and rock slide closed Highway 1 near the Monterey and San Luis Obispo County lines. The scenic road is one of the most beautiful in America and a popular destination for valley travelers. but it's also incredibly challenging to maintain. For the past year, crews have worked to clear the road and stabilize the hillside. Now comes news that the end might be in sight, with a planned reopening slated for next month. Here to tell us more is Colin Jones from Caltrans. Colin, welcome.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
So has there ever been a precedent for anything quite like this, this size, happening on Highway 1 before?
Not really. This was the largest landslide ever in the history of Big Sur. There was one in 1983 up near the Pfeiffer Burn State Park. But this one from May 20th of 2017 dumped 6 million cubic yards of rock, debris, and material onto the highway and into the ocean. So it was a massive slide of unprecedented magnitude. But Caltrans came up with a plan to really build a new highway right across the existing slide, the new geology and topography out there. Our contractor has been working 7 days a week, dawn to dusk, and it's a huge project, but we're real excited to be able to reopen that highway at the end of July. We've been fortunate with good weather, good working conditions, an excellent plan, an excellent contractor. So with this opening of Mud Creek, which is just over the slow Monterey County line, it will be the last closure point along Highway 1 from Cambria to Carmel through the Big Sur area.
Yeah, you had that other issue over in the Big Sur area last year, that bridge that was out. That's been resolved, right?
Yes, the bridge at Pfeiffer Canyon has been open since October of 2017. So this area at Mud Creek will be the last closure point along Highway 1. Once we open at the end of July, you'll be able to drive through Highway 1, Big Sur area, from Carmel to Cambria, unrestricted.
How challenging has it been to do this work just to, you know, for the sheer sake of safety with the hillside being so unstable? Tell me a little more about that.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is not only are we building a new highway across the landslide, we have to work both below it and above it. We have to stabilize the area down towards the ocean, which with new netting and rock abutments and embankments and drainage culverts. And then above it, we have to put netting and stabilize the hillside and cut things back and just contour everything so it's as stable as it can be and to safely reopen the highway. So basically we're building a highway across the new topography and mountain that was created after this massive landslide last year.
Now, I know in some areas up by Yosemite, in our area, there have been rock slides and things, and they've actually built or are in the process of building sheds where they allow the rocks to kind of go over the roadway. Is that what you're doing here, or is it just you're confident that the rocks above the road are going to stay put?
Yeah, no, we don't have a rock shed per se, but we have large drainage systems that will allow for more water flow, and we've done major stabilization of both the embankments above and below the highway. So, yeah, it's been a huge effort and, you know, something that we're very proud of. We understand it's been a huge inconvenience for travelers who come from all over the world to drive Highway 1 through the Big Sur area, a big impact to the business community in SLO County, especially the northern part, from Morro Bay up to Cambria, San Simeon, Hearst Castle area. But by opening it up by the end of July, those businesses are at least going to have the latter part of the summer to get back to normal.
Is Highway 1 the most difficult road you have to maintain in your district?
I would say so. It's probably the most heavily subsidized highway in the state of California. And as one of our longtime engineers once said several years ago, when you build a highway in the last 15 feet of the continent, you're going to have issues. And we certainly do. But it's an all-American road, one of 31 in the country. And as I said, people come from all over the world to travel it. Big Sur is an iconic destination, along with Hearst Castle and all the other points there. It doesn't have nearly the amount of traffic that Highway 101 has. You know, it's is anywhere from 3,000 vehicles a day to 20,000 along Highway 1. So it's not nearly as heavily traveled as Highway 101 or some of the bigger roads in the state of California. But it's certainly a major destination for not only state travelers, but nationwide people as well as an international destination.
Again, Highway 1 set to reopen and near the end of July as that road work is still underway after that landslide last May near the San Luis Obispo Monterey County line that's had the road closed. Can't wait to see that reopened. And again, we've been talking with Colin Jones of Caltrans. Colin, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Anytime.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 75 years ago, the streets of Los Angeles turned violent in an event that came to be known as the Zoot Suit Riots. The cause is still unclear, but we know this. For 10 days in 1943, white service members attacked young Latino men on the streets of Southern California while police turned the other way. The attacks are the subject of a new young adult novel by acclaimed children's author Margarita Engel. In 2009, the Clovis author's book The Surrender Tree won the prestigious Newbery Medal, the first Latina to receive the honor. She was just named the Young People's Poet Laureate by the Poetry Foundation as well. Her new book is called Jazz Owls, a novel of the Zoot Suit Riots, and she joins us today in our Clovis broadcast studios. Margarita, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the novel, I want to sort of set the stage a little bit, just as this has been in the news recently. The LA Times did a big piece looking back at the Zoot Suit Riots 75 years after they happened just a few days ago. When we talk about a Zoot Suit, what are we talking about here for our listeners who might be too young to remember this or maybe have never heard about this incident in our history?
Well, the Zoot Suits were very loose, cool clothing that the jazz musicians wore, and also then dancers started to wear them for doing the jitterbug and these other styles of dance during World War II that were very athletic, you know, and they were leaping around and throwing girls over their shoulders, and they needed freedom of movement. So the clothing was a big suit. It was loose. The origin of the name Zoot is mysterious, but they were considered cool. They were stylish. So freedom of movement and also to be in style.
And freedom of expression for a group of individuals who were living in a segregated society in Southern California during the war. And this brought about a very dark chapter in Southern California history. How did you come to the idea of taking this event and turning it into a book for children?
Well, I grew up in the neighborhood where it happened. I grew up in Northeast Los Angeles, not far from the armory where the sailors were receiving their basic training on the way to battlefields of World War II. And the sailors were coming from all over the country. And they were shocked by seeing interracial dancing. They were coming from areas where you wouldn't have seen, you know, Mexican-American teenagers dancing together with white kids, black kids, Asian, everybody dancing together. That just shocked sailors coming from the South. But my reasons for connecting to this story are several. First of all, that I grew up in that neighborhood. So these were the older people around me had actually experienced this. But also, many of the musicians were Cuban, and I was basically the only Cuban-American child I knew of in Los Angeles at the time, because it was before the revolution, so there hadn't been the massive waves of refugees yet. My mother came to Los Angeles to marry my father, who is from there. So I connected in that way also, imagining the roles of the musicians as they came into Los Angeles to entertain all these sailors and to be at the dances. Local girls were urged by the government to go out dancing with sailors to boost morale. And then I also connected with this because I loved the Zoot Suit play of quite a few decades ago, and the dancing in the play, but the play deals primarily with courtroom proceedings. And I wanted to look at family life, especially the young girls who often dropped out of junior high or high school to work in the canneries. This was a time when the roles of women changed from being able to do manual labor in the canneries to being able to move up to airplane manufacturing and jobs that had been traditionally only for men.
So you mentioned that you, growing up in Los Angeles, were around these people who were witness of this. Did they share stories about what happened back then? Do you remember those?
You know, I'm not sure how I actually knew about this. I read a lot, but I also listened a lot and eavesdropped a lot. So somehow it came into my body of knowledge. I'm not sure exactly where that started.
So I want to have you read something from the book in a moment. But before we do that, this book is very interesting, as are some of your other historical novels, in that it is entirely in verse and told from different perspectives. Tell me more about that.
Well, I love to write in poetry. And because my training was as a botanist and agronomist, in addition to studying creative writing, I used to look for a scientific reason. Why do I prefer poetry? But I've come to the conclusion after years and years of trying to make it complicated that it's very simple, that poetry makes me feel hopeful and poetry makes me happy. There's a freedom in poetry to search for the emotional essence of very complex situations. And the poetry is straightforward. It's easy to understand. It's written in these different voices, showing different perspectives of a complicated situation. But I feel like it's interactive for a child. Like the areas in a poem that look blank are actually filled with my emotions and the reader's emotions, and hopefully also I've been able to depict the emotions of the characters taken from history. So I think it's interactive in that sense, that the reader brings a lot. Children can actually write missing voices. If they see, well, yeah, this has lots of voices, but what would so-and-so say about it? You didn't, you know, include that one. They can write those themselves. It can also be used as reader's theater. There's a very thin line between this format and theater.
Tell us about the young women who are the characters, the central characters in this book.
Well, they're the sisters of one of the young boys who is attacked by the sailors. And the sisters are working in a cannery. These are teenagers who are no longer in school. They're working in a cannery to help support the family. One of them goes into union organizing over the course of the story, and the other one goes into the airplane manufacturing in the course of the story. So basically like a Rosie the Riveter type of job. But they, of course, are witnessing what's happening to their brother as he's attacked by the sailors, and this is a very emotional experience for them.
And you have something to read from this. Is this from one of these characters?
Yes, this will be a poem in the voice of one of the sisters, Lorena. She's the one who becomes a union activist and tries to get fair treatment for the women in their work. What will the future be like? While peach season leads to tomatoes, Maricela is gradually transformed from one person into another without losing her original self. I'm changing too. My hair bobs short, my clothes so deliberately dull that no one would dream of wearing them to a dance. I spend part of my paycheck on union dues for dignity and part on war bonds to help Papa and Nico fight for liberty from the Nazis' hateful ways. But who will struggle for freedom from racial hatred here at home?
That was Margarita Engel reading from her new book, Jazz Owls, a novel of the Zoot Suit Riots, something that happened 75 years ago in real life, yet still a story that's relevant today, as that last passage shares with us. Tell me a little more about how you think young people today might connect with this book?
Well, I think that once again, history is repeating itself. Quite clearly, Latinos have been chosen as scapegoats by racists. And I think we need to be really vocal and active in resisting that escalating racism that we see in that xenophobia, this fear of other countries and fear of strangers coming over our borders, even refugees in need of help. This happened, the Zoot Suit riots happened shortly after the Great Depression. Just a few years after, tens of thousands of Mexican Americans, many of them born in California, were rounded up and deported on trains to Mexico. Often people who had never been to Mexico before were deported along with their entire families. And in some cases, just people who looked Mexican to the authorities, so that a Native American might have been put on the same train and sent to Mexico. The press at the time profited off the fear, because fear sells newspapers. And so they would speculate a lot. You know, what if the Nazis are rallying in Mexico just over the border? And what if the people coming over the border are spies? And what if Japan's just about to bomb Los Angeles? And all of these things, even to the point of saying that Mexicans looked Asian and therefore they were probably in with the Japanese and wanting to bomb us too, and just ridiculous things. But it sold newspapers, making people afraid of their neighbors.
This new novel, again, Jazz Owls, a novel of the Zoot Suit Riots, what age group is it geared for? A young adult audience? Tell us a little more about who you're aiming for to be the target reader here.
In this book, I'd say ages 12 and up, but mature fifth grade and up. Sixth grade's probably better. The social justice units in school are often around eighth grade, and that's ideal.
Again, Margarita Engel, our guest today, talking about this new book, but another honor just received is one that comes from the Poetry Foundation. You have recently been named the Young People's Poet Laureate. What does that involve? It sounds like a great honor. I imagine it must be keeping you pretty busy.
It is a great honor, and there is a lot of travel involved. And I've also been able to do some things from home. The Arne Nixon Center at Fresno State helped me make some videos, for instance, including bilingual videos. But the Young People's Poet Laureate is chosen by the Poetry Foundation in Chicago. So it's a little bit different than the Adult Poet Laureate, who's chosen at the Library of Congress. The Poetry Foundation is a wonderful library and institution for promoting poetry, and it's an incredible honor to be chosen over all the other children's and young adult poets. I'm actually only the second one to ever include both young adult and children's poetry. They used to have just a children's poet laureate, and then a few years ago they changed it. It's a two-year appointment, so I'm entering my second year soon. I'm the 2017 to 2019 Young People's Poet Laureate. And as soon as they told me that I'd been chosen, I knew that I wanted a theme, and I chose the theme of peace. In particular, I speak to adults and to children and teenagers about building bridges, not walls, poetry for peacemaking. So I think that bridges and walls can use all the same materials, in this case, words. The only thing that's different is the direction, whether you're trying to separate people or join them, help us understand each other. And so in these very divisive times, I'm searching for ways to reach across and help people understand each other through poetry.
So I understand you're very busy nationally with this new honor and doing a lot of travel supporting the book and the new project that you just told us about. Where can people get the book? I understand you have some events coming up this fall, but the book is out now.
Yes, both Petunia's Place Bookstore and a book barn in Clovis, and then, of course, all the usual outlets online and so forth.
Yeah, always so impressed with the quality of our local authors, from poets to historians to novelists to young adult authors, as we have with us today, Margarita Engel, award-winning children's author and newly named the Young People's Poet Laureate by the Poetry Foundation. Her new book is called Jazz Owls, a novel of the Zoot Suit Riots. It's available now. Margarita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, you can send us your comments online at kvpr.org. And when you're there, subscribe to our podcast as well and take this program wherever you go and listen on demand. Again, it's the Valley Edition podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts and online at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and our reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, Mark Benjamin, and Christina Lopez, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.